This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The world's richest man dropped in on a major groundbreaking at CVG Airport this week and moved the first pile of dirt. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos oversaw the fanfare as the local community celebrated the beginning of construction of the new air hub coming to the airport. Plus, Cincinnati City Council is looking at legislation related to marijuana possession. What exactly is being considered? A new deadline for West End residents, if they agree to move, is offered up by FC Cincinnati. As rent and home prices increase and over the Rhine, there's a new effort to create more affordable housing opportunities. And Mayor John Cranley announces his plan for the city's budget. Let's start the Friday News Review with Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wedrick. Welcome back, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
And WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman.
Hi there.
Or is it Handsome Man? I was listening earlier this week, and there was some dispute over what your name
might
be.
Well, if you ask Marianne Zlesnik's daughter, it's Handsome Man.
That's right. 513-419-7100 is the number to call if you'd like to join the conversation about any of these topics. You can also email talk at WVXU.org or look us up on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to get some of those in the show as well. So Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley came out with his budget proposal this week. What's in it? How's it different than what we saw previously?
Well, the city manager had made about $16 million in cuts, probably the ones that were getting the most attention. He had made about $1.6 million in reductions for outside agencies that do things like neighborhood activities, economic development, and human services programs. So yesterday, the mayor came along and restored and even added some funding to those areas, about $3.1 million. And most of the big ticket items that the manager had cut in those areas, particularly in the area of economic development, the mayor reinstated those.
It was a budget miracle.
Yeah. So how does he plan to pay for it if the city manager says there's problems?
This is the one thing that I did think was interesting. Councilmember Chris Seelbach particularly has for several years said that the reason that the city is having major budget problems is because of state cuts to the local government fund, money that Columbus sends back to the local governments. And it has been significant, the number of cuts in that fund over the last decade. The mayor is counting on about $1.9 million in additional funding from the local government fund. Now, I'm sure that's not going to be enough to satisfy Councilmember Seelbach, who has complained about these cuts, but it is the first time that there has been any movement in Columbus to restore some of that local funding. And for the city, $1.9 million, that pays for a lot of things, and that's covering, you know, a lot of these expenses.
Is that guaranteed then, as the state said that this money's coming?
From what I was told, it was in at least the House budget, and they thought that it was going to survive through the budget process to be restored.
Have we heard from any of those service organizations that may have been hit by the city manager's budget proposal? Are they now a little happier since Cranley's budget has come out?
They were at the news conference yesterday. It wasn't a coincidence, I'm sure, and they're very pleased. You know, there were a few folks left out. The Hillman Accelerator, which helps small African-American business kind of accelerate. So that's one that kind of was left out. Of course,
the interesting thing is, I was just looking at my chart because I went through and highlighted what Cranley put back. That was the only one in the economic development category that didn't get put back.
Which is a little mysterious. We're not sure what the reason is for that. And of course, the mayor left out the Center for Closing the Health Gap, which is was founded and headed by his political nemesis, former Mayor Dwight Tillery. And so we expect the usual dispute over whether that money should be put back in or not.
No matter the size of the budget, there's always room to be petty, right?
I'm not going to say another word about it.
And there was a couple of things that Cranley added. There was I've got to get my numbers right. There was $250,000 for the $200,000. I'll get the right line. My glasses are failing me. $200,000 for shelter house in the operating budget and $150,000 in the capital budget. And what that's going to allow to do is the shelter house, which is formerly known as the drop-in center, now in Queensgate, they have a winter shelter in their basement, and that usually was only open in the winter months. With that, with the extra operating money and the capital money, they're actually going to make that now year-round. So if somebody needs is homeless and needs shelter even in the summertime, fall, beyond the winter, that will be available to them with that funding.
So we've seen the city manager's proposal. We've seen the mayor's proposal. What happens next?
goes to council, and then council begins to try to make any changes that it wants.
So is council the one that sort of reconciles these two proposals, or do they have the opportunity to come up with their own ideas?
They can come up with their own idea.
They can amend it however they want. They have the power of the purse in this case, and that's usually what happens. This is just kind of an annual kind of a dance that is done. The city manager's budget always seems a little draconian, and then the mayor comes in and as if he hasn't talked to the city manager and just restores a lot of the money, and then council gets its turn, and it will probably restore some of these items. And what will happen then is the mayor probably will tell them that they're spending recklessly, and then there'll be a bunch of back and forth in public over that. And
well, what type of pushback do we expect? So I'm wondering. I mean, do you expect anybody on council to say, mayor, you're being petty by putting this money into?
There's always there's actually, I think, fewer of those things this year than maybe in the past. I think there'll be a scuffle over the health gap because three council members, Wendell Young, Landsman, and Denard, and usually PG Sittenfeld and Chris Seelbach go along with this, usually want to restore that money. And, the mayor vetoed that last year and they overrode his veto. So we'll see what happens this year.
And there were in the general manager's budget, the city manager's budget, there were nine positions in the city's general fund that were eliminated, and then those nine people are being transferred to other city departments. One of those was a department director, Larry Falcon, who heads the Office of Environment and Sustainability. I think that's the department.
Yep.
And then a gentleman, his last name is Lonizak. I think it's Jonathan Lonizak, who is basically the aging czar, deals with issues primarily dealing with senior citizens. His position was cut, and I know at least
just
one.
Just as your eyes started to fail, if I recall the beginning of this interview. That's unfortunate.
It's convenient.
There's at least one council member that I think they're going to try to figure out a way to restore at least some of those nine positions back into the general fund.
So city council's also discussing marijuana this week. What exactly is this proposal that's going around, and who's pushing it?
Well, it's basically pushed by Vice Mayor Christopher Smitherman and Councilman Jeff Pastor, which is interesting because they are kind of regarded as two of the more conservative members of council. Smitherman's an independent, Pastor is a Republican, but they are both African-American, and they both believe that the state and federal laws on marijuana have unfairly attacked African-American people, and that's kind of the impetus for them bringing that measure. Basically, they're calling it decriminalization of marijuana. Now, in Ohio, it's kind of already decriminalized for possession of 100 grams or less. The only difference in what the city is doing versus what the state is doing, the state will or has done, the state fines you $150 if you're caught with weed. The city wouldn't have any fine. In both cases, there is no court record, and they're both classified as minor misdemeanors. But this ran into some turbulence at council. They didn't have the needed votes to suspend the rules and pass this immediately, but there is clearly a majority in favor of it, and Mayor Cranley sounded like he was for it and that he will sign it if it's passed.
So has there been any misunderstanding about what's in this law? Is there confusion about, we're legalizing, recreational pot in Cincinnati?
I think when people hear decriminalized, and Chris is right, it's a minor misdemeanor, but you still, even the first line of the ordinance, no person shall knowingly obtain, possess, or use marijuana in an amount less than 100 grams. So you still can't have it. Mm-hmm. It's just if you get a citation from the city's police department, it would come with $0 fine, no jail time. And they're saying no court costs. I'm not sure. I was trying to confirm that this morning. I'm not sure that if it goes through the court process that there aren't some mandatory court fines that have to go along, even if it's no fine. But I wasn't able to get an answer to that question. But basically, it's slap on the wrist and you move on.
It's like a jaywalking ticket.
What exactly has the pushback, if any, been about? What has it been about the size allowance for this 100 grams, which producer Pete Reitmeyer tells me is 3.5 ounces. He's converted in our studio back there.
That's a lot of
marijuana.
A lot of joints, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you're buying on the street, they tend to, it's like quarter, half ounce. I mean, ounce tends to be
And let's remember, too, there are actually two proposals. They only voted on one or tried to vote on one this week. That one was under 100 grams. There's another proposal. The original proposal was under 200. And I think the mayor said that he was going to let that come forward at the next council meeting. So council will have to decide, you know, will it be under 100 or will it be under 200?
The mayor's preference is 100 because the police chief has kind of said to them, well, if you're going to do this, and he's not really said he's in favor of it, but if you're going to do this, make it 100, don't make it 200.
Yeah, because then you're at 7 ounces of marijuana. And the other doing the math correct,
right?
And the other thing, too, this would only apply if the city police department was involved. So if someone's in Cincinnati and they were to be stopped for some reason by a Hamilton County Sheriff's deputy or a state highway patrol trooper, they could still be cited under state law, which would be the $150 fine.
Unless you're in Norwood. Didn't Norwood do something similar? Has there been any talk about the comparison?
Well, they've talked about that, but Norwood voters passed a similar proposal, but the police department there is still enforcing state law. Which is
okay. So the fine is still relevant,
right?
And that was one of the things that the council was trying to make sure, you know, that the police department wasn't going to just simply start enforcing the state law. And I feel like they got the answer that they would comply with council's wishes on this. This is actually an ordinance, so it's not a motion where the administration can be like, "Oh, that's nice, but we're going to do what we want to do."
And I think we asked the police chief on Monday after this was before Law and Public Safety. And I'm not sure that we know exactly what's going to happen because literally if the fine's $0, no jail time, you're just passing – you're just giving them a piece of paper that says it's going to end up in a zero fine. So do they – you know, is it like a warning? Are they – you know, what's going to happen? You know, if they're going to charge, are you going to get a citation and go to court and say, okay, well, no money, no jail time, go on your way? Or do they just bypass that whole process, say you're not supposed to have it? And move on.
And the police will still confiscate this marijuana, I imagine.
That's a good question. I would assume so, but
that would be my assumption.
Yeah.
Okay, but we're just assuming.
That did not come up. That's a great question.
Okay, well, we should follow up on that. So you said procedurally there wasn't a vote on this yet. So when does this happen?
Probably next week. They need six votes.
Seven
votes to suspend the rules and go to an immediate vote, and they only had six on Wednesday.
Just because I'm a policy geek, if you're saying suspend what rule? Ohio law says that any ordinance is supposed to be read at three different council meetings, and you can suspend that if three quarters of the members say you can, which takes seven. Councilmember Greg Landsman was absent this week, so that took the number down to eight. Two of those members were opposed. So that only left six, so that's why they were a vote short. If he's back this week, I would assume they'll have the seven for suspension and probably be able to pass it.
Right. And Council Member Amy Murray and Council Member David Mann, Murray's a Republican, David is a Democrat, and they were, you know, they thought this process was going too fast, that they had 1 45-minute hearing on it on Monday, and they thought that was not really enough. And, you know, I think the David Mann, you know, has some other concerns about, you know, well, you know, what if this is a gateway drug, or, you know, are we going to have people walking down the street token, and, you know, what's that going to make our city look like? So,
well, it's interesting that if you're viewing this through a partisan lens, that you have the biggest proponents for it being from, I can't say opposite sides of the political spectrum, but certainly different angles of the spectrum. And
right.
Then you have a Democrat and Republican being the two opposed. 513-419-7100 is the number to call if you'd like to join the conversation about these issues we're discussing on the Friday News Review today. Chris, the state of Ohio and the city are working together to push for more affordable housing in Over the Rhine. What has happened on that front?
Well, basically, the state has made available to Cincinnati, Cleveland, and Columbus a $3 million for each city, $3 million pot of tax credits. The cities get to pick one neighborhood where they want to either preserve or enhance mixed income housing, meaning that you have poor people and middle class people and rich people living all aside, you know, alongside each other. And so Cincinnati has chosen Over the Rhine as a place where it believes that can be done. And so that's where the city is planning to allocate these tax credits. They believe that the tax credits, which developers can use as part of their financing for the project, they can use them to really leverage about $30 million in housing. And so that is the hope. And they're going to spend about $1 million a year of these tax credits in Over the Rhine.
You noted a pretty interesting statistic. A recent study by City Observatory found that there are only 1,300 neighborhoods in the entire country that qualifies both diverse and mixed income, with 7 million people living. So we have over 300 million people in the country, only
not
7
very
million
many
living in a ethnically and economically diverse neighborhood. The report found that 20,456 people in greater Cincinnati, or about 1.4% of the population, lived in a neighborhood with a high level of racial and ethnic diversity, next to last in the nation.
Yep.
And that Las Vegas, by comparison, had 44.2% living in those circumstances. So that's what this is trying to fix, is right. to bring more people who are different living together in the same neighborhood. And the city also considered Walnut Hills and Avondale. Why did it settle on Over the Rhine?
It had better they thought they had better projects potentially in Over the Rhine, and better in the sense that they were more family oriented, right? They didn't want to just fund a bunch of studio apartments, and the developers that are working in Over the Rhine made the case that they're going to, you know, basically be able to put families together with the units that they're going to build. And so that means they need to really be two bedrooms or more. And so, you know, we've typically seen that in Over the Rhine. And so, you know, that's kind of the thrust here. And, you know, Cincinnati's always, you know, well, it's been a segregated city for a long time. I think that's not a secret. And so they would, you know, there's a lot of discussion, right, about the stereotypes about Over the Rhine. Oh, you know, it's all rich white people moving in. Well, this is an effort to make sure that the neighborhood maintains the character that it's known for, at least right now, that it has a diverse set of people living there.
And who gets to do the development? Do people have to make proposals, or will the city utilize a variety of developers?
I mean, there's already been proposals from mainly the groups that already work there, 3CDC, the Model Group in particular. There are some others as well, but you know, there'll be a variety of projects that are eligible for this.
All right, let's talk about Amazon, because yes. Jeff Bezos himself flew into town for this groundbreaking.
It was a surprise.
Yeah, it was a big surprise. And he got in that piece of construction equipment. I've already forgotten what type.
Front end loader.
Front end loader. Can you tell I live in a city and I've never worked with my hands before? He got in a front end loader and caused quite a spectacle. Which that may have been his first time in one of those too, unless he's moved books around back in the day.
He appeared to know what he was doing.
Yeah, he did.
I'm sure he had some training beforehand.
He had
you know?
The sleeves very perfectly rolled up and was prepared for the photo op. But anyway, the point is he was in town for this new big air hub that's coming to Boone County, where the airport is. Just what are the basics of this project?
So it's a massive building. It's one of the, I think it is the largest building in the Midwest that they're going to construct. It's 3 million square feet. It's on more than 500 acres at the airport. The airport's been waiting for an opportunity like this for a long time. So it obviously seized the opportunity when Amazon approached it in the state of Kentucky in 2017. And we won this project over Wilmington's airport, where Amazon had been kind of experimenting with flying its own planes and doing some of its own logistics. So it's a major deal. It's going to be a $1.5 billion investment in the airport and in the state, basically. And so you had every dignitary that you can think of in the city down there, and everybody was sipping champagne, and it was a bright, sunny day, and you know, people were very, very excited. And you know, when Bezos came on the stage, everybody kind of had to sit in their seat. Like, there were some, you know, reporters like to move about, and I guess we were told, sit tight, you know. So it was, you know, we kind of had an inkling that something was going to happen, but we weren't sure that it was definitely going to be Bezos arriving. So he came on stage and talked a little bit about the project, got in the front loader, and you know, he was gone in about, I would say, 20 minutes. He took some selfies too.
So. Oh yeah, I noticed. And Mayor Cranley from Cincinnati, of course, was over there in Kentucky for this too. And I saw on his Twitter feed that he said, "We will not oppose any Amazon jobs." So it looks like a last second Hail Mary pass to see if that old project would resurface. But
I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, it seems like a long shot. But speaking of jobs at Amazon, what kind of jobs do we expect to have?
Well, I asked a little bit about this. And so, like, the pilots themselves who are going to fly the planes, they're going to actually work for a couple of airlines that do this logistics work for Amazon, FedEx. So they're not actually going to be Amazon employees. The company leases the planes from Atlas Air and I can't remember the other company off the top of my head. But the actual workers will be doing kind of the things that you expect of Amazon employees. They'll be sorting the packages. They'll be routing them around this giant building and putting them on airplanes. And then the airplanes fly across the country to all of these other little logistics stations that they have. And so it's kind of their first attempt to do their own shipping. And, you know, we'll see how it works. They're very excited about it. They love to talk about how no one else does this, but no one else is of their size either. So.
Yeah, so CVG Airport is, what, the eighth largest cargo airport in North America, they're saying?
Then they've like increased cargo shipping like 54% in the last 3 years. And that's also because they have DHL Super Hub down there. So when you're shipping packages overseas, chances are anywhere in the country through DHL, it's coming through CVG.
That's why we get all those interesting news releases from the Border Patrol every now and then about the creepy things they found that people are trying to send before they're confiscated. Just one last thought on this is how big of a deal do you think CVG Airport CEO Candace McGraw is right now after landing these things?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I think we've talked about this on Twitter, you know, just 5 years ago, they were trying to get rid of Candace McGraw, the kind of the good old boy network in Northern Kentucky. And, you know, the airport prices are lower to fly out of there. They've brought in all this business. So it was interesting because the FAA official there to kind of mark the occasion went out of his way to praise her unprompted. And
He said basically whatever she says to do, you need to do. Yeah,
like, this is striking, really.
What to do. Awesome. All right.
You have to wonder, though, would she still have her job if it wouldn't have been for somebody accidentally leaving their cell phone on in their back pocket when they weren't supposed to have their cell phone
That's
on?
That's right.
In their back
I'd forgotten about that.
It's true. You're talking about the board chair, former board chair Jim Huff. Who was, I guess, working to have her removed. And one of the conversations was recorded by an assistant. Or I mean, it's been a few years now, so like it's a little hazy, but you're right. And that led to a lot of coverage and ended up that the whole board ended up reformed. Somebody
without that call,
election.
She could have been gone.
Right.
I don't think you're wrong. Well, before I let you guys go, we have to talk about soccer stadiums because it's Friday, and that's what we do on the Friday Soccer Roundup.
And there was a little news yesterday, right?
There was a little bit of news. So FC Cincinnati is now offering the residents of the West End in two properties there a new deadline to leave, but only if they sign on to some new agreement. So what's the agreement?
Basically, FC wants to give them $2,500 and pay for their moving, and they have to agree to leave by October. Well, they have to sign this agreement by May 31st, and then they would actually have to leave these buildings by October 31st. FC would give them free rent because FC is not a Section 8 landlord, it says. No real substantive response from the attorney for the residents of the Wade Street and Central Avenue buildings. His name is John Schreider. He's with the Legal Aid Society. He says, you know, they shouldn't really be trying to negotiate this in the media. And the solution that has been offered is that FC would deed the Central Avenue building over to the city, and the city would then deed it to Seven Hills Neighborhood Houses, which is kind of a community development organization and social services over there. And it would become permanent affordable housing. FC does not want to do that. They clearly have plans for that spot and maybe others, but they're not revealing what those are.
And the team blamed, quote, outside activist and, quote, media coverage, probably from Jay Handsome.
Yeah.
That's encouraged tenants to, quote, forego other housing options and remain in the buildings, even though the buildings will be closed down and will not be used for residential housing. So we've seen FC Cincinnati leadership get snippy recently with city or county, I guess primarily city leadership. And now they're turning at the media, too.
I don't know what to say. All we do is say what people said. So,
well, I think part of it, I think they're hoping that council will the city council has a role in this in a week and a half. They're going to consider a zone change that they need to keep the stadium project going for a couple of little rights of way. And I think the folks who are trying to maintain this housing are hoping that they can tie council objecting to that zone change to working out an agreement for these residents. And we'll see. It's coming up. I believe it's the Wednesday after Memorial Day. There's a public hearing, and then the full council could vote on it that next day on Thursday.
The clock is ticking for FC on this. They need these zoning approvals to keep building the stadium.
So. Well, they were also pretty mad at their head coach, too, it looked like. So
yeah.
I guess it's kind of a tough front office right now. I want to thank Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich and WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman for joining us today. Up next, a project to create broadband internet access in the far reaches of Kentucky seemed to be a noble endeavor, but it doesn't have quite as much money as it needed, and now it's an issue in the Commonwealth's gubernatorial race. We'll talk about the troubled Kentucky Wired project, and later, how the city of Oxford is coming to terms with racist lynchings that took place there a century ago. This is the Friday News Review on Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Kentucky Wired is a state project to install more than 3,000 miles of fiber optic cable across the Commonwealth. On paper, the project promised to connect roughly 1,000 government sites to one another and the internet. But it's not working out as planned. The project is having some financial difficulty, and now it's an issue in this year's race for governor. Let's continue. The Friday News Review now with Louisville Courier-Journal reporter Alfred Miller. He joins us on the phone. Welcome, Alfred.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Anybody who has questions or comments about this, give us a call at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter, and we'll look for your comments and your tweets. So, Alfred, you had an article this week at the CJ that had the headline, "What is Kentucky Wired and why is it such a mess?" So my first question is, what is Kentucky Wired and why is it such a mess?
As you said, it's a plan to improve Kentucky's internet infrastructure by basically draping 3,000 miles worth of fiber optic cable across the state. The cable would connect about 1,000 government sites. So it doesn't actually, I think there's a misconception that it would connect individual homes and businesses. It doesn't go all the way that last mile to the home. But the network is supposed to sell access to itself to third-party internet service providers, and the idea is that would then spur growth in high-speed internet. So,
so what's the messy part?
The messy part has been trying to get all of this fiber, well, trying to get it attached to these utility poles. So, I think about 80% of the project is hung from utility poles owned by companies like AT&T. That's something we highlighted in the story, how difficult it has been to get agreements to attach onto those poles. The bigger picture, though, is that the people who were promoting this project at the end of the Bashir administration in 2014-2015, they promised that this would cost Kentuckians only about $30 million. According to the state auditor's report last September, in fact, taxpayers are really on the hook for $1.5 billion.
Okay, so from $30 million to $1.5 billion, that's 50 times what they right. were originally told, according to your reporting. And also from your reporting, you said that's because the state quietly assumed most of the risk for this public-private partnership in the closing weeks of the previous governor's administration. That was Democrat Steve Beshear. And that was according to a September 2018 report by state auditor Mike Harmon. So when all of this came to light, and with all of this in the light now, does it look like Kentucky Wired moves forward?
I think it's still an open question. There's a state senator from your neck of the woods, Chris McDaniel, who's been very vocal about wanting to shut it down. In February, he made a move toward that, eventually back down, but it could still come up again, for sure.
Chris McDaniel is a Republican state senator who represents Covington and Kenton County in the state Senate. So, yes, this dates back to Steve Beshear, a Democrat. It had bipartisan support, though. So who else was behind pushing this back when this first came up?
So when you say it had bipartisan support, you're referring to both the governor and Congressman Hal Rogers.
Yeah, so Hal Rogers has been really a representative from Eastern Kentucky in Washington for almost 40 years, so a pretty powerful name in that region.
When Governor Bevin, one thing we highlighted in the report is that when Governor Bevin took office, he initially wanted to scale back the project, maybe just to Eastern Kentucky, where Hal Rogers' district is. And he's been sort of sending mixed messages since. So at first he wanted to scale it back, then he said he would continue as planned the full statewide project. But more recently, his IT chief, Chuck Rendell, who has the power to direct where state agencies get their internet service from, whether it would be from a company like AT&T or the state-owned network that eventually will be lit, Kentucky Wired. He's been pretty critical of the project in public, saying it was a terrible project. It was underhandedly done. So calling into question whether the state agencies that are supposed to be on Kentucky Wired would actually switch over.
When we talk about the cost of the project basically increasing 50 times from $30 million to $1.5 billion, I just want to go back to the original $30 million. How was this supposed to be funded?
The state pays right now a little under $30 million for its internet service from companies like AT&T, and the idea was to shift that spending from those companies to this Kentucky Wired project.
I see. So this is money that was previously earmarked for private companies specifically and now would go to this project.
The project was also supposed to generate its own revenue. So if you have this network, then you could sell access. The idea was you could sell access to the network to these, you know, third-party internet service providers that they envisioned would spring up and want to provide internet to, you know, rural areas in Kentucky. But the network's not yet lit. It was supposed to be completed in 2018. It's not going to be done now, probably until October 2020. That's what they're projecting. But if you don't have a network, you can't sell access to it, so you can't generate revenue. They were predicting, you know, over $1 billion in revenue for the state just by selling access to this network, and that's, you know, we're still waiting for that.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We're talking with Alfred Miller. He's a reporter with the Louisville Courier-Journal, and we're talking about the troubled Kentucky Wired project. And Alfred, I want to read part of one of your articles on this situation. We're talking about Governor Matt Bevin now, who's been in office for nearly four complete years. And although this started under the previous governor, Democrat Steve Beshear, Governor Matt Bevin, a Republican, is dealing with this now. And your article says, Bevin administration officials have been sending mixed messages about the project from day one. At first, Bevin said he would scale back Kentucky Wired, but after meeting with Congressman Hal Rogers, he said he had solved the project's funding problems without saying how. Has he since said how?
It's unclear how the problems have been solved, but it's by design, this public-private partnership that Kentucky negotiated with an Australian investment bank, Macquarie Capital. It's difficult to get out of. I mean, Macquarie is a sophisticated player. I spoke with a researcher in this area, and he says that a guy named Aaron Wren at the Manhattan Institute, basically, when you're dealing with a sophisticated player like Macquarie, be wary, because breaking out of this deal it's going to cost just as much as completing it. So it's a problem that I don't think Bevin has a clear answer to.
So if Governor Matt Bevin is defeated for re-election this year and a Democrat takes over, it looks like this project will stretch into a third governor's term. And so the Democrats running for governor next Tuesday's primary have suggested that Bevin is at least partially to blame for this current situation. What do they tend to say about this?
Well, so I spoke with representatives for all three candidates. Rocky Adkins, he blames the governor for not keeping the project on schedule. Adam Eveland has made rural broadband part of his platform. He called Kentucky Wired half-baked, which is sort of a dig at Andy Beshear almost, because this is his daddy's project. And then also criticized Evan for not caring enough to fix it. And then Beshear, his campaign manager told me that they want to pick and choose what's working and what isn't, and see if they could fix it. Although, as I said, breaking out of the original agreement isn't so easy.
Alfred Miller is a reporter with the Louisville Courier-Journal. Alfred, we appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. A number of black men were lynched in the greater Cincinnati area during a brutal period about a century ago, and now the tragic crimes are being remembered in the city of Oxford. Meanwhile, some Cincinnati neighborhoods are seeing a dramatic increase in Latino residents. Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Mark Kernute joins the Friday News Review now. Welcome, Mark.
Hey, Michael. How are you?
513-419-7100 is the number to call. If you'd like to join this conversation, email talk at wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to get some of those in the show as well. So first, Mark, take us to this lynching story. What was the catalyst for exploring this period?
This is part of the Equal Justice Initiative's Legacy Museum and National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama, where at the memorial, about 4,400 African-American lynching victims from the 19th and 20th centuries have been memorialized. And they've kind of organized that memorial by the counties in which those lynchings occurred. And in our area, Oxford is part of Butler County. They had eight lynchings in Boone County and one in Claremont County.
So how are they being remembered?
A couple of different ways. What happened in Oxford on Monday night was following a semester-long graduate truth and reconciliation course that was taught by Valerie Robinson and Anthony James, two African-American scholars at Miami. They investigated and read and wrote about lynching, especially the two in Oxford, and as part of the coursework went on spring break to Montgomery to tour the memorial, to tour the museum. And part of the memorialization project is to collect soil at the sites where primarily these men, these African-American men, were lynched, whether they were shot, hanged, beaten, dragged by a horse, whatever the means the white mob took. And in Oxford, they had two victims, Sim Garnett in 1877 and Henry Corbin in 1892. So the first part is to collect soil from the sites where these lynchings occurred, and then those jars, uniform jars, are stored in the museum in Montgomery. And then the second part that the Oxford group is working on, the Miami Oxford group, is to get a duplicate steel memorial that lists the names, the towns, and the dates of the lynching. They hang in the memorial, and then there's an adjacent garden where duplicate memorials are stored. And the goal is then to have the local government bring that duplicate memorial to the site, to the county, and display it as a memorial to the lynching victims from that period.
You profiled some descendants of these lynching victims, including Henry Corbin. What is their perspective on this all these years later? Because Henry Corbin, in particular, he was accused of murdering two women,
one woman, his white employer was the accusation, none of which was proven in court.
Okay, so he was accused of this. I'm reading in your reporting that I have here. He was working as a handyman for a prominent white woman, Georgiana Horner. And then one January afternoon, according to the Inquirer at the time, Corbin killed the elderly widow by striking her on the head with a piece of firewood. Her daughter, Lizzie, surprised Corbin during the violent act, and he turned his weapon on her before escaping. That's why I assumed that there were two victims,
right?
Just one, though.
Right, just one. And, you know, so he was killed. He was shot, beaten and hanged, and as he hanged, his body was filled with several hundred bullets. The family, however, I reached through some research, I found a descendant of his, Chris Corbin, who is now 69, and she is a retired accountant who lives in northern Kentucky. And Chris and I went to Oxford a year ago when the memorial was opening, and we retraced Henry's final steps. And the oral history within the family, which is often the case because media, the newspapers in that day were complicit with the official white narrative, was that basically in the family, the Horner family, the daughter was marrying against her mother's will, and that she had killed her mother and blamed Henry. And the family said that Henry's crime, with quotations around it, was he had the audacity to make eye contact with a white woman in uptown Oxford before she spoke to him. And that day, African-American men especially, who were stereotyped as being aggressive and over-sexual and all this other falsehoods, that's what he did. And he was snatched from his home that night and hanged north of town at the site of the historic covered bridge. And so when Chris was up there, she collected soil from both the uptown site and the covered bridge site. And that is what the scholars in the program did the other day, as they went to the, even though there were the conflicting sites, they collected soil into the jars that are being shipped down to Alabama.
Two lynchings in Butler County, you said eight in Boone County.
Correct, and one in Claremont.
So are they collecting at all of those sites?
Well, right now it takes some local initiative, and at this point neither Claremont nor Boone County have shown any initiative. Again, it was the two scholars at Miami that pursued this, and they had Chris Corbin come up and speak to the course before they went down for spring break. And again, they're now where they're at now is they're working with other governmental agencies and parts of Butler County to try to get broader engagement and interest in bringing the permanent memorial to bring it to Butler County.
Earlier this month, you had some reporting about what's driving some migration to some Cincinnati neighborhoods, including East Price Hill. And there's one school in particular that has seen an absolute surge of new Latino students. So talk about what's going on here.
Well, what's happening is, in spite of the crackdown at the border and some of the, you know, the very highly controversial projects and applications and programs of the administration, there is a drought in the Northern Triangle of Central America affecting Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, where an estimated 2.8 million people are food insecure and are starving. And so in spite of the crackdown at the border and the separation of families and the great risk that families take coming north to the United States or attempting to cross, increasing numbers are attempting to cross. And even the Department of Homeland Security has issued documents saying that the drought, basically every crop except coffee, has been adversely affected. That's what's driving this newest surge. For example, Cincinnati Public Schools, with primarily Roberts Academy and East Price Hill, have seen 900 new English as second language students come since the first of the year, or since the first of the school year. There's been increasing surges since January, another surge they noted since the first of April. And then even the Catholic schools, where families can use EdChoice vouchers, St. Lawrence is now 44% Latino, and Holy Family, also in East Price Hill, their school is now 59% Latino. And the Immigrant and Refugee Law Center in East Price Hill is also seeing an increase. They had cleaned off their waiting list, which has now gone back up to 40 families waiting for free legal services.
Are these students undocumented, or are they here illegally?
From what I understand, many are, but some, from what the experts tell me, the lawyers, the advocates, some people in the schools, what they're noting is that slowly some of the children that are being united with their parents who were separated at the border beginning last summer, that some of these families are being reunited, or some of the unaccompanied minors are being allowed to come to parts of the country where they may have family members. So if there's an aunt or an uncle living here, so in the case of people who have been detained, they are somewhat documented because the government knows who they are and where they are.
So is there any indication from the schools about how the children are acclimating? Are they happy here?
From what I hear, they're happy because if they're reunited with family instead of being held in detention and sleeping on dirt on ground or witnessing things that they probably shouldn't witness at their age in detention, there's a resilience and there's things, Michael, that you and I as privileged white Americans can't even begin to understand. And so there is a hope. There's always a hope in that community that things will get better and there's great risk taken and resilience shown.
Mark Carnute is a reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. We appreciate you being back again today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstrow. Find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.